Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I don't know. I just got really excited. Couldn't say that. Couldn't get it out.
Psychedelic.
I guess I'm so fired up to be back for this hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And we've already got the questions. All the questions have come via the internet. We call this an internet open forum. Often we get these questions because Jimmy asks for them. They'll go on. What do you do? Facebook? Where do you? Or
Facebook, yeah. And I go on and I post a note and say, I've got a pre-record coming up. Does anybody have any questions? And they turn them in.
Yeah.
And then some of them are asking smart aleck questions that I have to just delete and it wastes my time. But I thank all the people who turn in the actual questions.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of smart alecks out there. Not me. Never.
And I'm actually, you know, as you know, I'm really generous when it comes to what I'll count as a real question.
Yes.
So it if I'm saying it's a smart aleck question I have to delete, it has to be really,
really smart. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Really, yeah, not a serious question.
And that's such a funny thing. Sometimes we'll see on the sheet, you know, when a caller's on the phone and I'll see the question and I'll think, this is somebody that's just messing with us. But then the person gets on and the question is actually quite sincere. They just see it in a different way than I saw it. And I thought, so you never know.
But if someone is asking, what's the airspeed of an unladen swallow? I mean, that's just a Monty Python reference. Like, the obvious follow up is, what do you mean, a European or an African swallow?
Why am I coughing? 888. No, stop it, Cyril. Get focused here. I'm going to read a question now because I'm all over the place. Because I'm all fired up for Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Michael asked this question. A friend adopted two Cocker Spaniels that are double Merles. These dogs are bred with the full knowledge that one or two of the litter.
Only one or two.
That only one or two of the litter won't be born blind or deaf or both. And these will often be put down, which is why my friend adopted them. We agreed it was a rather cruel custom, but then I thought it was no different than how God created humanity and the full knowledge that many would need to be put down, he says, to hell. Yet we have free will, but he knew this would be the case and created us anyway. Seems like there had to be a better way, or at least no way at all.
Okay, so I'm not being asked about the ethics of breeding dog breeds that will have this kind of level of birth defects. So since I'm not being asked about that, I won't go into that. However, there is a difference, and Michael's alluded to it, between the situation with regard to double Merle Cocker Spaniels and humans, which is humans have free will. You know, if you're a double Merle Cocker Spaniel dog, you don't have any choice about whether you're born blind or deaf or whatever. But if you're a human, you do have a choice of, do you want to accept God's love or do you want to reject it? And that's a free choice. And so there is a relevant difference. Now, we've talked before multiple times about why would God create someone who he knows is going to go to hell? And this is just an aggregate case of that, you know, in kind of an enlarged form, because presumably there are people in the human race who go to hell. And so, you know, this is just a larger form of that same question. I'm not going to go through all the answers here. If you want to read more about the possible answers to this question, you can Google, why would God create someone knowing they're going to go to hell, Jimmy Akin, and it will bring up a page on my personal website, jimmyakin.com, where I talk about the different possible answers to this, and this is really just an aggregate or group application of those answers. I tend to favor the view, this is just my personal view, one of five I present in the piece, but God is classically understood to have all knowledge of actual things and the things that will actually occur, you know, in the future and in any period in history, and a knowledge of all possible things. But some theologians have speculated he might have another kind of knowledge known as middle knowledge, which is a knowledge of what would happen if he did something different. Like, if I created this person, would they go to hell by their own free will? And I'm actually skeptical of God having that kind of knowledge. It was not the common understanding, for example, in the Middle Ages, that God had this type of knowledge. This proposal really didn't get made until the 1500s. And it's not church teaching. It's a matter of theological speculation. And to me, the idea of knowing the outcome of a free will decision, so if it's free will, that means the outcome is not determined by anything else. And so if you never make a free will decision, its outcome is never determined. So it's saying that God knows the outcome of a free will decision that is never made sounds to me like saying God knows the shape of a four-sided triangle. You know, it sounds like it's involving a logical contradiction. And so I tend to not favor the idea of God having middle knowledge. And thus, God, in order to know whether someone is going to choose love or reject love, God has to create the person. And so it's a, I would say it's a false way of visualizing God's manner of operating to say, oh, he knew people would fall before he created them by their own free will, that they would fall and go to hell. I don't know that that's the case. I think God creates the people and instantly sees what they do with their free will, but I think there's a misframing of this logically. Now, that's my opinion, and not everybody has to agree with it, and there are other opinions too. But one thing the church does teach, and this undergirds all of the different opinions on this question, is that God would not allow an evil to exist unless he had a way to bring an equal or greater good out of it. So whatever, there are different ways you can explain this, and I go through those in the article, but whatever is happening here, God is generating an equal or greater good by allowing some people to freely choose to reject him.
Thanks very, very much for the question. I'm not comfortable with that double moral thing. I didn't know that. I know that you're not going to address that one, but makes me
unless I'm asked, Sykelet.
Jimmy, it seems to me cruel to breed animals knowing that you're breeding animals that have debilitating defects, like the double. This, I don't know. This is the first I've ever heard of it. So this person may be misrepresenting it. But if it is as represented, that doesn't seem right to me. That seems immoral.
Yeah. Well, so animals have no rights. And thus, we're not intrinsically harming, we're not doing something intrinsically evil to the animals. However, we do have a duty based on our own human nature to be kind and humane in our treatment of other creatures that God has put into our care. And so consequently, we should not cause animals to suffer unnecessarily. And that then involves two further questions. One is the capacity of the animal to suffer, and the other is the good that is being achieved by allowing them to suffer. Is it sufficient to compensate for the suffering? Is there some good that's being achieved that makes up for the suffering? Well, in the case of some creatures, I don't think they have a robust capacity for suffering. I think they have a capacity for suffering. I just don't think it's very big. Like, for example, mosquitoes.
Oh, yeah.
Mosquitoes are so simple as organisms that I'm sure they can suffer a little bit, but not in the way a dog or a human can suffer. And so I don't think you need as much of a compensating good to justify causing mosquito suffering. And in fact, there have been experiments that, you know, produce mosquito suffering. This is something, for example, that's been done in the case of studying genetics. You know, one of the things that early geneticists found was that they could generate all kinds of bizarro mosquitoes by exposing them to radiation. And so you're irradiating them to affect their genes. And then you get all these weirdo mosquitoes that have like, you know, they've got a leg growing out of their mouth, or they've got, you know, two heads at funny angles, or they are born with twice the number of wings they should have, or, you know, all kinds of bizarre things. And I'm sure those mosquitoes suffered, but they're just mosquitoes. And the knowledge that we gained about genetics and how genetics works offset that suffering, I would say. So yeah, there can be a legitimate reason for that. What about dogs? Dogs are much higher beings. They're able to suffer much more than mosquitoes are. They're much closer to humans than to mosquitoes in terms of their ability to feel and comprehend what's happening to them. And so I would say you need more of a reason to justify the suffering of such animals. If you're creating a breed that's going to have, let's say there are six puppies in a litter and only one of them is going to be healthy, well, this is an actual concern that, you know, applies to dog breeding today. Now, I don't know the specifics of double merles, but I do know that there are criticisms that have been made of various people in the dog breeding industry that certain breeds are so medically fragile that there's the argument you shouldn't make them. Like, for example, some dogs have these really smashed faces. You know, British pugs are an example of this. But some of them, they've got these really smashed faces, and it interferes with their ability to breathe. And that's gonna be suffering for the whole life. Should you really breed a dog like this? Now, I would assume that some dog breeders would say, these creatures, as compassionate as we need to be to them, they're not human, and they don't have rights. And the benefit of the one that survives and is healthy in the litter is sufficient. You know, the humans that are going to enjoy that dog and cherish that dog, that good is enough to offset the medical problems that the other dogs are going to have. At least I assume that's how they would argue. It seems to me that that's a legitimate argument for them to make. If they can show a corresponding good that would justify the suffering of the others, then that's reasonable. On the other hand, I think we shouldn't too quickly accept such an argument. We should critically examine it and say, is having a dog of this exact breed, is that going to really be enough to compensate for the suffering that that dog or its litter mates are going to experience? And I think that that's a matter of practical judgment that there is no single answer to, but those are the principles that would need to be brought to bear on the question.
Thanks, Jimmy. And thanks, Michael, for the question. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Thanks for being here with us. Jimmy Akin is our guest, Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Of course, you can always find new material from Jimmy Akin every Friday at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World or at mysterious.fm. All kinds of new mysteries investigated each week on Friday morning.
So this week we did second part of Ellen Gould White. You want to know what we're doing next Friday?
Yes.
Socorro, New Mexico, Lonnie Zamora UFO encounter. It's one of the best documented UFO landing cases. It left physical traces. And so we're going to be telling you all about what happened in the 1960s in Socorro, New Mexico.
Was that a highway patrolman or a police officer?
Yes. Lonnie Zamora was a highway patrolman who witnessed it. And it was a case that was impressive enough. It impressed J. Allen Hynek, who was one of the most respected UFO researchers of the day.
All right. Back to the UFOs next week on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Here, it's internet open forum. That means it's just like a regular open forum, except all the questions have come to us via Facebook. And this one comes from James. Do you know any good stories of persons leaving the SSPX or other schismatic organizations and returning to full communion?
So I'm certainly aware of people who have gone to the SSPX or to various schismatic organizations and then returned to the Catholic Church. In terms of stories that I can recount off the top of my head, the answer is no. But we do publish in every issue of Catholic Answers magazine a conversion story. And we have people from a lot of different perspectives who have converted to the Catholic Church. I would go to Catholic.com and type in conversion story SSPX and see what comes up, or conversion story seat of a contest and see what comes up.
All right. Thank you very, very much for that question, James. This one comes from Michael. My question is, why have certain pockets of American Catholics lost their schismatic minds and Catholic Answers is silent about it? I'm not even sure what that means. I guess you know what it means.
Well, I assume that Michael is viewing Catholic Answers as silent in the face of various American Catholics entertaining schismatic ideas. And I would reject that. I'd say, no, we don't. We talk about schism with some regularity.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean it's our primary mission. It's not. Our primary mission is apologetics and evangelization. Part of apologetics and evangelization is helping people who have gone into schism, but that's not the entirety of it. And we tend to operate in a couple of ways. One way is reactively. So when people ask us about schism and such problems, we respond, like I just did in the question immediately before this one. You know, someone asked about, hey, how can I find conversion stories, or how can I get conversion stories from these perspectives? And I said, well, here's a way you can do that. So I'm happy. And that's just an illustration. Other people call in on the show and they say, here's this argument someone gave me. What do you make of that? I'm happy to answer it. So there's a kind of reactive approach. There's also a kind of active, not reactive, but active approach, where we produce materials that can help deal with schismatic issues. And you can find those on Catholic.com. You can find them in our online store at shop.catholic.com. So we actually are not silent on this. The number of people who are actually of American Catholics who have gone into schism in recent years is actually not huge. I mean, it's a real problem. It needs to be addressed, and we are addressing it. But the number of Catholics who have left the church altogether is much bigger.
Right.
And the number who have left for other groups is much bigger. Schismatic Catholics are really, frankly, not a big group. And so we do try to be responsible in both proactively publishing materials to address those concerns and in reactively answering concerns when they are brought to us. But it's not the core of our mission. And so it should not take over the mission. We shouldn't become obsessed with this as if it's the only problem that needs to be addressed, because frankly, there are much larger problems that also need to be addressed.
This is one of those things, too, where the word schismatic is used for a lot of conditions that don't seem schismatic to me. I guess that's why I said I don't know exactly what he's talking about.
Well, I'm leaving that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some people who are schismatic, and so I'm just assuming that's who we're talking about and not engaging on well, let's technically define this
right,
and so forth.
Right. Well, thanks, Michael. I'm glad you asked the question. This next one comes from Bennett, who asks, if or maybe when time travel becomes possible, would you want to travel back to the first Easter weekend, or would you want to travel to anywhere in Jesus' life apart from those last days?
Okay, I need to know, is this an exclusive or an inclusive or?
Oh, yeah.
In the question. In computerese, would the logical operator be OR or XOR? What I'd really like to do is travel to both. I'd love to witness Jesus on Easter weekend. I also, though, would love to go to another point in his life. In fact, I'd love to go to multiple points in his life. But assuming I have limited access, let's say my TARDIS only has enough power for two trips. Well, sure, the crucifixion to Easter Sunday, that would be one of the places I'd want to visit. But I'd also want to visit earlier in his ministry. And I'd like to visit when he's got some downtime, because I'd like to ask him questions. I could clear up so much and get so much interesting new information if I could, you know, have an interview with Jesus where he's not being distracted by other people. I mean, I'd love to see him, you know, perform some miracles. And that would be an enormous blessing to be able to witness that. I'd also, though, I'd love to be able to ask him questions and in a situation where he has the time to answer. So like that kind of rules out Easter, because he's kind of busy on Easter. You know, you just look at the number of resurrection appearances recorded in the Gospels alone. He's busy at that point. So I'd like to find Jesus when he has some downtime and could clear up a few matters for me and give me some insight into mysteries that aren't even mentioned in the Bible.
All right, yeah. Bennett, that's a really cool question. Thank you very, very much for that one. Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's Internet Open Forum. Sean asks this. You know what? I'm going to read two questions at once because they're related to one another. Sean asks this. If Jesus was nailed through the wrists, why do some stigmatists have the wounds in the palms of their hands? And then Suzanne asks, and why do some artists put a nail in each hand and each foot, a total of four?
Okay, so the first thing to say, I guess, is it's debated exactly how the nails were positioned with regard to Jesus's hands. You will sometimes hear people say, oh, they couldn't have been through the palms because the palms won't support the weight of the body and the nail would just tear through. And therefore, he must have been crucified through the wrists. Well, okay, not so much, because people were crucified in multiple ways. And just to give one example, sometimes they tied the arms in addition to mm-hmm. nailing them, in which case the ropes that were used to tie the arms would relieve some of the weight. And so you could be crucified through the palms. Also, there have been studies done with cadavers. And there are people today, even though their bishops strongly tell them not to do this, there are people in some parts of the world, like the Philippines, who will get themselves crucified for Good Friday. So I don't think it's at all certain that Jesus would have been crucified through the wrists. It's possible, but I don't think it's a given. Also, there's a kind of intermediate position where you angle the nail through the palm and it comes out the back of the wrist. So it goes through those dense bones that you've got in your wrist. And that's another way it could happen. But let's suppose that Jesus was crucified through the wrists. And nevertheless, stigmatists frequently have the stigmata on their palms. Why would that be? Well, here's where the second question becomes relevant. Suzanne asks, why do some artists put a nail in each hand and foot for a total of four, whereas other artists have one nail in each hand and one nail through both feet for a total of three? Well, the answer artistically is because that's how they envision it. I mean, we're not told in Scripture exactly how many nails were used. So different artists have envisioned it different ways. But there was a fascinating discussion of this question in the book Heroic Virtue by Cardinal Prospero Lambertini back in the 1700s. He became Pope Benedict the 14th. But while he was still a cardinal, he wrote the classic work on canonization. And in it, he talked about what visionaries would see in their visions. And so that's our cliffhanger. We'll talk more about that and the nails when we come back.
Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum, but it's an internet open forum. All of our questions are from the internet. Two questions on the crucifixion of Jesus currently on the table. We'll get back to that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life. But only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Slipped a little bit of groovy music in there because Jimmy's here. We're doing an open forum. A little bit of what we usually get on Thursday, we got on Friday. I like it. I like it, Zach. And we got the groovy music on Thursday as well. So this is a big week for us. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's an internet open forum this hour. And Sean and Susan asked two questions about the crucifixion. One about why stigmatists don't always have the wounds in the same place on their body. And then one about why some artists put the nails in different places on the body of Christ in their artistic depictions of the crucifixion. And we're about to find out what the classic work on apparitions has to say about this. That was our cliffhanger.
On canonizations, actually, but it includes apparitions.
Okay.
And so one of the questions that Cardinal Lambertini treats in the book is, why do some visionaries see Christ crucified with three nails, while other visionaries see Christ crucified with four nails? This was something that apparently was causing some people a bunch of indigestion. It's like, come on, it had to be either three or four. Which was it? I mean, is this a sign this other visionary is false because they have the wrong number of nails? What was it actually? Which visions are true? Well, Cardinal Lambertini said, dudes, chill.
That was the best 17th century kind of language when they would say,
yeah,
that. Dudes.
He said in a very courtly way. But
chillest thou self.
Yeah, because the number of nails is not the point. One of the things that Cardinal Lambertini and Catholic theology in general has recognized is private revelations are not videotape recordings. And as a result, they are shaped by the background and consciousness of the seer. And consequently, some visionaries had seen depictions of Christ being crucified with three nails. Some visionaries had seen Christ being crucified with four nails in artwork. And so that's what they saw in their visions. God wasn't trying to teach the visionary exactly how many nails or exactly where they were. Was there one nail through both feet or two nails with one through each foot? That's not the point of the vision. God is not trying to teach his history with these. He's trying to teach you that Christ was crucified for your sins. And so he lets you see a vision of Christ crucified, and your imagination, based on your previous experiences with artwork, fills in the details. And that's essentially the answer to our question about stigmata. Why would, if Christ were crucified through the wrists, why would stigmatists have the wounds in their palms? Because God is not trying to teach you where the wounds were. God is trying to help you feel close to Christ and enter into the sufferings of Christ that he undertook out of love for you and for the rest of the world. And if you understand those sufferings as involving wounds in the palm, that's where the stigmata will show up on you, because it's God's way of reaching you. And you shouldn't look to the location of the wounds as if they're a historical record of exactly where Christ's wounds were, because that's not the point of the stigmata. The point is, it's a way of being close to Christ in his love and suffering for mankind. It is not a history lesson about exactly how the crucifixion was done.
Sean and Suzanne, thank you both for those questions. It's an internet open forum this hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and our next question comes from Jason, and I'm not sure if it has a pun in it. Are birthstones in the same vein as astrology? You know, because stones come in veins.
I just struck a vein of gold something.
Right.
Yeah. As far as I've been able to determine, the answer is no. Having birthstones is a very recent concept historically. You will find people who will say, ooh, it's based on how the breastplate of the high priest in ancient Israel had 12 stones on it for the 12 tribes of Israel, and there are 12 months in the year and so forth. And it's like, yeah, actually, no. That's true. There are 12 months in the year. It's true that the high priest's breastplate had 12 precious stones in it that represented the 12 tribes of Israel. But this has nothing to do with a person's birth month, which is what birthstones are. A birthstone is a stone that you can, if you want, you can get, and it's based on the month that you were born in. Like, I was born in August, and there are actually different lists of birthstones. They varied over time, but one of the ones that is common for August is peridot, or peridot, however you want to say it. So if I wanted, I could go and get a peridot and maybe like have a ring made out of it or something. And yeah, it's my birthstone. But this custom only goes back a few hundred years. It does not go back to pagan times. As far as I can tell, it has no connection to astrology. It's not like the birthstone is supposed to channel power from the stars or anything like that. It's not supposed to be particularly lucky or anything. It's just a symbol of the month you were born in. And jewelers like to sell them because jewelers like to make money. And so various jeweler associations have come up with a list of, you know, different birthstones for different months and as a way of marketing them. But there's nothing spooky or mystical being attributed to these, at least in the context that I'm aware of. And I have looked into it, and I didn't find anything like that in Western tradition. I can't rule out that there were people who would attribute powers to the stones. In fact, actually, you would have found that in history, because for a long time, it was believed that various birthstones not birthstones, but various minerals did have effects on people. For example, St. Hildegard of Bingen says that if you have someone who's suffering from epileptic fits, you can take an emerald and put it on their tongue and they'll get over their fits. She thought emeralds had this medical ability. And you had lots of others too. I mean, almost every substance was tried in European folk medicine for something. But that's largely unrelated to astrology. And in a few cases, people were right. Some substances do have medical benefits. Like, for example, copper has antimicrobial properties. That's why, for example, you will see doorknobs in public buildings made with some copper in them, and why water pipes in buildings are frequently made out of copper, because the copper has a tendency to kill microbes. And so the copper-based doorknobs are self-disinfecting to a degree, and the water pipes will have a somewhat disinfecting effect on the water. So some substances did have medically beneficial effects, but there was a lot of squishy science in the day because the scientific revolution hadn't occurred. So in history, you could find people who would attribute special properties to gems, but that has really nothing to do with the modern practice of birthstones. If someone thinks that just because they were born in a certain month, a particular stone is going to be beneficial to them, just because they were born in that month that the stone represents, well, that's superstition. But you can't look at birthstones and say, oh, that's just astrology. Where it's automatically superstition. A person could get a birthstone just because they like the stone and they want to commemorate their birth. It's kind of like having different items that commemorate different wedding anniversaries.
Yeah.
You know, and there's nothing intrinsically superstitious about that. There's nothing intrinsically superstitious about birthstones.
Jason, thank you very much for the question. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's an internet open forum today. This one comes from Tom. I'm a wishful skeptic regarding Bigfoot, Tom says.
Me too.
By wishful skeptic, I mean, I don't believe in Bigfoot, but I wish it was real. That would be fun. What are your thoughts? Is it possible he's real? It seems that by now we would have stumbled upon the remains of a dead Bigfoot.
Okay, so the answer is going to depend on how, and by the way, I did a very early episode of Mysterious World. It's something like episode 3 on Bigfoot. I will be doing more in the future because I have more that I can bring to the discussion now. The answer is going to depend on how you conceive of Bigfoot. The classical understanding of Bigfoot is that Bigfoot is a natural animal that is perhaps closely related to humanity. It may belong to the great apes, but it's a very human-like but otherwise natural animal. That is not the only understanding of Bigfoot. There are also supernatural and paranormal understandings of Bigfoot. But sticking with the standard natural understanding for the moment, is it possible that such a large bipedal creature could exist in the United States today and yet remain undocumented by science? Well, it's possible. There are lots of undiscovered animals in the world. These animals are sometimes called cryptids. Cryptos is Greek for hidden. And so a cryptid is a hidden animal, one that science does not know to currently exist. And actually, you know, you can estimate how many cryptids are out there, how many different species remain to be discovered in a given environment. And we, by various estimates, actually probably most species have not yet been discovered by science. But there are some big exceptions, because the larger a creature is, the more likely we are to run across its body and thus obtain what is known in science as a voucher specimen. If you have a voucher specimen, you can scientifically describe and classify the animal, and it becomes known to science. So if it's a big animal, you're more likely to have it. You're more likely to run across its corpse, and you can then classify it. Also, if it lives where humans have easy access to, like land, you're more likely to run across it. And if it's where technologically oriented humans are, like where there are lots of scientists, you're yet more likely to have run across it. So most of the undiscovered creatures tend to be really tiny, like microbes and insects. Or if they're bigger, they tend to live where humans don't, like in the sea.
Yeah.
Or they live in remote parts of the world where there aren't a lot of scientists, like in jungles. So what are the odds that you would have a 7 or 8 foot tall biped living in the United States on land where we have lots of scientists compared to developing countries? And there's going to be a stable breeding population of these things, and we never find their corpses. It's not impossible, but as Tom indicates, the fact we don't have a voucher specimen for Bigfoot is an argument that Bigfoot doesn't exist. And so I think there's reason for skepticism, but I'd love it to be true. Now, everything I just said is on the normal interpretation of Bigfoot as just an animal. What if he's not? Well, there are proposals that Bigfoot might be an extraterrestrial creature, because there are some instances in which Bigfoot is seen in conjunction with UFO sightings. And aliens might collect a body.
Oh, yeah.
Or they might not put a sick Bigfoot down in the first place. If Bigfoot is an interdimensional, his body might go back to whatever dimension he came from. Or if Bigfoot is a supernatural creature, then his body, he may not leave a physical body. You know, there are some, for example, there is, in some traditions, there is a belief in what's sometimes called a thought form or a tulpa, which is essentially, the idea is if you have enough people believing in something, it kind of takes on its own existence.
Oh.
And so if you have lots of people believing in Bigfoot, then a kind of spiritual thought form of Bigfoot could exist. But then if that thought form dies, it's just going to dissolve. You're not going to have a body. Now, those theories about Bigfoot being alien or interdimensional or a thought form are out there. They are harder to believe to me than the idea of a natural biological animal, because we got lots of natural biological animals on Earth. The existence of thought forms, interdimensionals, and extraterrestrials is much more speculative, but loads of biological animals. It at least would explain why we don't have a voucher specimen if those were true.
They do look like Wookiees.
Uh-huh, sure.
So,
but they also precede Wookiees.
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah, right. So the Wookiee might be based on Bigfoot rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
The classic documentary on Bigfoot, of course, is Harry and the Hendersons. You might want to check that out. But, Tom, thank you very much for the question. Am I supposed to take a break right now? I am? Okay, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum right after this with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, open forum with Jimmy Akin. That's pretty hard to beat. But what about this? What about when it's an internet open forum and all the questions are cool questions that came to us via the internet? Well, that's what we're doing right now. This one comes from John. What Star Trek non-human species are most likely to be what aliens would look like?
Oh, boy. So there are a couple of issues with this. The first one, and part of me wants to say none of them, but there's also a sense in which you could say all of them, because almost all the intelligent species on Star Trek are human actors with some kind of prosthetic makeup, you know, like bumpy foreheads or something like that. They've even poked fun at that on the Star Trek comedy series Lower Decks. That it's like it's always humans with bumpy foreheads or wrinkly noses or something, or pointy ears. And they do that because of technological and makeup and budget limitations. You know, they couldn't historically have effectively made a really alien looking creature. And had it be an intelligent, interactive character on the show. Maybe the closest they ever came was the Horta, which was the silicon creature
that went through the rocks.
That looks basically like a big blob.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool creature. It's unlikely for a couple of reasons. One is the Horta doesn't have any visible means of manipulating its environment with fine detail. I mean, it does do it, but it doesn't have the equivalent of hands. And so that's an issue. Also, it's silicon. And while silicon-based life is theoretically possible because silicon occupies the same column of the periodic table as carbon, and so it has properties similar to carbon, there are actually a bunch of problems because it's heavier than carbon. And it could only exist in really specialized circumstances. So silicon life is possible, but advanced silicon life is very, very improbable. And then you've got all these others that are basically the same body plan, you know, with just little details like that one has pointed ears, that one has a bumpy forehead, that one has a wrinkly nose, and they're all the same basic body plan. So they all pretty much are in the same category. It's not like I could say, oh, Romulans look more like real aliens than Bajorans do.
Yeah.
What I can say is that the idea of a humanoid body plan representing an intelligent creature is not bad, because if you look at our body plan, there are several aspects of it that would be conducive to intelligence. So in order for a creature to be an intelligent, technologically advanced alien, or an advanced, technologically advanced being, it's probably going to need to move around in its environment, you know, because if you're sessile, if you're stuck to one spot, you're not a very good predator. And you're also not able to run away from predators in your environment. So you need probably some means of locomotion. And if you're on land, if you're land-based, that means you need legs. And it could be two legs, it could be four legs, could be one leg, but you're probably going to need legs. And so that's it's reasonable that we would have those and be intelligent. Also, though, if you're going to be technologically advanced, you're going to need to be able to manipulate things in your environment. You're going to need to build technology, and that means you're going to need fine motor control. And that means you're probably going to need hands or something very much like hands. You know, you look at dogs, they've got those paws.
Yeah.
Dogs can't type, you know, dogs don't have fine motor control. They can't, that's one reason dogs don't develop technology. They don't have the ability to manipulate objects in their environment the way we do with our four fingers and our opposable thumbs.
They manipulate people.
Yeah, exactly.
That's their skill.
Yeah. Also, probably... you would have front-facing eyes because what front-facing eyes let you do is, like we have, is they give you depth perception. And depth perception makes it possible to track your prey. That's why we, as predators, have front-facing eyes. It's also why lions and wolves and other predator animals have front-facing eyes, because when you got the two eyes close to each other, you can use the two different fields of vision to coordinate and figure out how far away is that animal I want to literally put the bite on.
Yeah.
You know, whereas prey animals like cows and horses and bunnies, they've got side-mounted eyes. They don't need depth perception. What they need is an expanded field of view to look for the predators around them. Well, one of the things about prey animals is they tend to be smarter because it requires much more brain power to outthink a prey animal than it does to outthink a plant. So bunnies don't need to be very smart because their prey, grass, is not very smart. It, you know, bunnies can just munch away and the grass has no ability to defend itself against the bunny. But if you're a human and daddy's gone a hunting to get a baby bunting, he's going to need to outthink that rabbit. And so, predator animals need evolve so that they're smarter. And that means they also tend to have front-facing eyes. So a technologically advanced entity like us would probably be a predator. It would probably have front-facing eyes and the ability to do fine manipulation of objects in its environment in order to produce technology and be able to move in its environment. That's also important for being a predator. You need to be fast and able to outrun your prey. And so a bipedal body form like we have is not a bad one. It is not the only possible one, but it is not a bad one for a land-based intelligent creature. Now you shift that so that the creature is no longer land-based, all bets are off. Like, for example, if you're in the water, you don't need legs. You know,
yeah.
how many things in the water have legs?
Right.
But octopi and squids are freaky smart. They're not as smart as we are, but wow, they are a lot smarter than you would think. And if evolution had taken a somewhat different path, you know, they might have become, under God's providence, they might have become intelligent. And you could have an octopoid based body form for an intelligent creature too. It's got the tentacles that allow fine motor control. It's got good eyes. It's got the ability to move in its environment. So the bipedal body form like most Star Trek aliens have is not a bad body plan, but it's not the only possible one.
John, thank you for that great question to close out our Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World dropped this morning with the second episode on
Ellen Gould White.
And tell me again what next week's episode is.
Saqqara UFO.
Oh, yeah. One of the most highly attested to UFO sightings. Jimmy, thanks. Always appreciate it. It was fun doing it with you.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend and a great Halloween.
You too. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.